Hi, everybody. This is Armand DeMille.
And this is Roberta Maria Atti.
Right here with you with the Positive Mind, WBAI 99.5 FM. Nice to be back with you. Sorry for missing yesterday, but glad that we were able to provide you with the programming that we did only here on WBAI. You know, nowadays it becomes more and more difficult to deal with people and their different idiosyncrasies because people seem to have so many different personal interests. But every now and then you run into somebody who you have difficulty with. Just plain you have difficulty with. Today we're going to talk about dealing with difficult people. We want you to get some of the tools that we have in dealing with difficult people. Now, usually a difficult person is someone who is working from the negative side of their personality rather than a conscious desire to be difficult. The person's often unaware of themselves and how the impact they have on people. But it's not always from the negative side. So let's talk about some of the different kinds of people that might be considered difficult by you or other people. And we're going to start off with the classic one, the angry or negative person who is angry or negative almost all or most of the time. They never have a good thing to say. Something negative to say about just about anything.
And then we have the fearful person, the anxious, nervous, the person who can't sit still, who is agitated and agitating, can't calm down, and
can't calm down from nervousness, which is very important. They seem to be frightened. It's like a Woody Allen on caffeine.
Right.
You know what I mean? I mean, very nervous type of person, very difficult to be around.
Mm. Then we have the overly emotional individual, the one who seems to be living in a very dramatic world all the time and is continuously expressing some kind of intense emotional current and seems to be in need of sharing that with other people. It's not just something that they live in and of themselves. It's something they want to share.
So this is, notice the three people we're talking about, the angry or negative person, the person who seems to be hostile most of the time, a very nervous person, or the extremely emotional person, you know, who's living a very dramatic life and they have drama with practically everyone. You all know somebody who's like one of these, or you may be one of these. And when you deal with somebody who has very high emotions about everything, or someone who is very, very nervous, or someone who is angry all the time, you put them away. You separate yourself from them in a way because they're difficult to deal with.
But see, I think we should say something, Armand, right around now that is important. I'm sure everyone can recognize themselves in any of these that we just mentioned, because some of the time we all experience intense emotions. We're all scared and angry and hostile and resentful and everything. So there is a subjective difficult individual and there is an objective difficult individual, meaning that at times we may experience someone as difficult, but there may be something that's off with us, and maybe that person would not be experienced as difficult by someone else. Whereas there are some people who seem to have found a groove, so to speak, of behavior or thinking or whatever it is that makes them objectively difficult and that everyone would recognize as, you know, quote, a difficult person.
Whoever you spoke to about this person, if you said to them, you know, you mentioned their name, they say POTS. Do you use the expression
like
POTS?
I don't know.
It's the
POTS,
one we grew up with, what it meant, like doozy POTS, which meant...
Oh, pazzo.
Pazzo, which means, you know,
well,
in a way...
That, That means crazy, but it's not just crazy. It means someone who is so different from normalcy in a negative way that everyone, unless they are a, you know, missionary or something, a saint, would have difficulties dealing with
it. And them. I've heard people described by that by people who know people over time. You know, you work with somebody for a while. At first, they're very sweet, they're very nice, they're very giving. And then after a while, boom, you just say to yourself, that person's gone.
Mm.
That person's not on my radar. But Roberta makes a very important point. There is a subjective and there is an objective way of looking at it. And let me give you an example of that. Usually, and this happens sometimes in the workplace, I heard someone who was helping me with this talked about the seductive person. You could have a man or a woman who is overtly sexual. Or, I mean, they wear extra short shirts or tight shirts, or they wear short blouses or skirts or high heels, and they're seductive. And the eyes follow the person, man or woman, around the office. Now, if you're one of the people who are bored at work and you like the stimulation that is provided by this overly seductive person, that's one thing. But if you're somebody who's sitting and you notice that all of the attention goes away from you at the moment and it's hard to get anything done, subjectively, you're going to have difficulty with that person. Objectively, that person may not have difficulty with the rest of the people. So you have to consider that each person, it's one of our questions here, and we're going to help you deal with just about everybody. One of our questions here, is it a subjective or an objective person? And a good example of this is Roberta on the train this morning. Roberta brought up a wonderful question about it this morning on the train.
Well, I was sharing with Armand that I usually enjoy my mornings when they are nice and quiet. I like silence, I like a peaceful beginning of my day, meditative. And on the train, when I have to leave early and I have to get up on the train with the commuters, you know, some people are very chatty and they speak very loudly and they carry on in conversations and on and on and on, and they laugh and they make noise. And here I am sitting on the train, and my nervous system is, I perceive a sense of friction on my nerves, literally. And of course, I know what the cause is. The cause is these two women who are having a conversation like what I just described. And immediately, what does my mind do? My mind says, oh, that caffeine high is unbearable. Here I am, I'm trying to start my day in a peaceful mode, and this is like a jolt to my nerves. But see, the caffeine high is my judgment. And the truth is that maybe there's a part of me that wishes that I could be like that at that time of day, you know. And the truth is it takes me a while to get into gear. So I ask myself, you know, what's wrong with them? That's my mind. And then my heart says, no, Roberta, what's wrong with me, with Roberta?
So, again, set and setting, and we talk about what you bring to it. If you are, so the subjective experience is, look at those people, they are so chatty. The objective experience is, look, people having a good time. You know, they're having a nice time with each other, they're having a good time.
And that could be applied to almost any situation where we perceive someone
as irritating.
Being difficult, mm-hmm. Yeah.
Now, the other thing we tend to do, once we identify the enemy, once we look up and say, it's their fault that I'm nervous, the next thing we do is we look for some kind of validation. So we'll look around the room and find somebody just like us, and if we catch their eyes, then we will roll our eyes, and they'll roll their eyes too, and that validates it. It makes the person who's laughing and having a good time wrong, and therefore we have a right to be irritated.
And we're ganging up with someone else against them.
So this is Armand DeMille with Roberta Maria Atti. We're talking about dealing with difficult people, and here is the interesting thing. Here is the objective and versus the subjective. Now, if a couple of guys get on the train And they're wielding knives and chains, and they're tattooed, and they're...
And they beat up somebody.
And they may, even if they don't beat them up, but if they're just loud they and curse, threatening.
Right.
And they're threatening, and they're mm-hmm. that way, and that's the way they enjoy themselves.
Then
you know?
Most of the passengers would perceive them as difficult.
Unless you're somebody who is okay inside yourself, and you may not. If you're somebody who works with these people, if you're a social worker who works in the same neighborhood, if you understand this style. You see, somebody once said, and I thought it was quite a beautiful thing, that people who are difficult are generally erratic, and erratic behavior is a powerful weapon in a world where you feel inadequate. So now this is a very important thing. Many of the difficult people that we see who are difficult and behave in difficult ways that we see or imagine are unmanageable are people in effect who are saying, I don't belong in this world, I'm inadequate in this world, so I'm going to be in this world in a special kind of way. I'm going to be louder, I'm going to be softer, I'm going to be more dramatic, I'm going to be crying. Whatever it is a strategy for dealing in a world where they feel inadequate. And with this, I give you the first hint of one of the ways that you could move your mind around seeing people who are difficult. We have a lot more information about this.
Well, I just wanted to say something about what you just said, Armand, that if you can figure out how to engage in some behavior that keeps other people off balance all the time, well, then you have an advantage in a world where you're not sure which way to go, right? So if my screaming, let's say, being highly emotional, if it keeps everyone around me walking on eggshells, careful not to trigger me, in a way it separates me from them and I lose something. But what do I gain? Well, I gain some kind of control over them.
Yes, you do. You have the weapon of hysteria.
Mm-hmm.
You have this whip that you could wield, and
right.
you could start screaming at every moment,
yeah.
and they'll be afraid of that, and if they see you as being potentially screaming, so it gets reinforced. It's not like, you know, in most worlds, a single behavior gets extinguished. Because it doesn't succeed.
Survival doesn't allow it, right?
You know?
But in a strange world, survival may demand it, actually, may require it.
When I was a kid, I remember I grew up on the Lower East Side of Manhattan, and there were mostly gangs, and I was about, maybe 12, 13 years old, part of the gangs, and every now and then we would have to go uptown. Now, uptown was this heaven, which was above 14th Street. Anything above 14th Street was the place that we didn't belong. It was where the privileged people were, you know, mm-hmm. above 14th. We had everything below 14th Street. So I remember we'd get on the train, and when we were on the train, we were such wise-ass kids. We would be loud, we'd be wise-ass, and I remember, you know, one guy who used to look around the train, and if somebody would, he'd say, "What are you looking at?"
Mm.
Just immediately trying to find the balance, because we felt we didn't belong above 14th Street.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't our neighborhood.
Right.
Funny. So when people do that nowadays, I kind of understand. I giggle. It doesn't.
Sure.
It doesn't faze me. But there are people who are very difficult to deal with one way or another. You may not have difficulty with them. What about drunk people? You know, let's talk about that. Somebody gets on and they're drunk and therefore unpredictable.
Mm.
Objectively, they're very difficult to deal with. Subjectively, if you have had alcoholism in your history as a child, you may be able to deal with it better.
Sure. Yeah. Well, of course, if you've grown up with a difficult individual, that gives you an advantage in dealing with people who have who display a similar behavior. But that doesn't make that person any easier to deal with. But
what do we know about people who are drunk? We know that they're potentially not inhibited.
We know that they can be annoying, repetitive. They can be aggressive. They can be verbally unpleasant. They can be obnoxious. They can be excessively sweet. They can laugh too much. They can fall asleep, you know, in the middle of the train.
Conversation.
Yes. So they can do a number of things that are odd or that could be annoying. But, if you have grown up in a house where you have seen this day in and day out, you may feel less disturbed by it than someone who's not used to it, for sure. And that's true even for rage or even for aggression. If you grow up in a house where you have a parent who is in a rage most of the time, well, you may have one of the two. Either you can't stand to be around anyone who is rageful, or you're nonchalant about it.
If rage was there all the time, you could stand it. It's when the rage was intermittent that you couldn't stand it as much. But I think about some of the family dinners I've been to on the Italian side of the family. Everybody yelled about everything. I mean, yelling was my standard of my family, but they would just yell loud voices at each other.
But yelling doesn't imply anger.
No, it doesn't.
Italy, so it's more of a style of communication.
Absolutely, but if you get on a train and people start loudly yelling at each other, you get scared if you're not used to this. If you're from Connecticut.
Connecticut, you know, again, Connecticut. Our favorite. Yes.
You know, and you suddenly start hearing people being aggressive. You know, look up and you look like you have to defend yourself. Again, we talk about the subjective and the objective.
When I was little, I used to listen to Beethoven's symphonies, and I used to read about him, and he was a very difficult person.
Mm, weren't they all?
So was Mozart. Mm-hmm. A lot of geniuses. I don't think Einstein was an easy guy either. A lot of geniuses are very difficult people. So there's also something to be said for the abnormally gifted. It's not just the deviant that we might feel threatened by or uncomfortable with, but it's also the extremely gifted and powerful and, you know, creative and anyone who is different.
Well, now let's say there's a good reason why, Roberta. Very often you're trained, let's say you're a production assistant to Madonna or to a rock and roll star or Mick Jagger, and you're a production assistant, and your job is to help them get their production on the road, and they need certain things. And you will be trained in how to deal with nasty and demanding rock stars. And you're trained in it, and you don't take it personally. And if they call you a twerp or whatever they call you, you just understand this is part of their anxiety, part of the way they get on stage. If you want to get something from the person who is a difficult person, your behaviors are very different than if you just want to exist with them. So now we come to another understanding. Mm-hmm. In understanding how to deal with people who are difficult, you have to understand what do you want from them. If you meet somebody who's very difficult and angry and mean, but you want sex from them, you know, you're going to kind of deal with it one way than if you don't want sex from them. Mm-hmm. You know,
if you want a job from them.
If you want money from them,
right.
You know.
Yes.
If you want something from somebody, you're going to not only overlook, but you're going to manipulate. You're going to work with. You're going to take that very thing they do and work it in your favor.
So then who is the difficult one?
Well, we all are. We're all part of the system.
I mean, in that example you just gave.
Sure. Let's say you get on a train and you've got, or not on a train, you take a look at bikers with tats, with tattoos and chains, and they're normally physically aggressive people. That's a kind of difficult person to deal with because you feel threatened by their size, by the bigness, by the darkness, and by the reputation. Another kind of person that we feel difficult with is people who are directly oppositional. And I want to describe this. And I also want to say that, remember, people might just step up to this position when they're under pressure. if somebody gets nervous, they may become a difficult person. But when they're not nervous and they're not under such pressure, they don't become a difficult person. And a good example of that is oppositional behavior. Oppositional behavior is when a person says the opposite of everything you say. And it's very hard to realize this because you don't find out until later. If you listen to a replay, you would hear it. But you'd say something like, you know, I want you to know I'm feeling very sad. And they'd say, you're not sad, you're angry. And you'd say, well, I am angry, and I'm angry about what happened yesterday. You're angry about what happened today, too, and I want you to know, and no matter what you say, they say the opposite, and the key to this is they never ask you what you mean. They never want more information. They're always just oppositional. Teenagers are known to do to decapitate their parents. Right?
Yes.
This is a way of making your parents be completely powerless.
But it goes to the extreme of something is obviously red, and the parent says, this is red. And the child has to say, no, this is green.
They have to.
They have to.
You see the compulsory opposition, which is very important.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Now, friends, once you notice that in somebody and you see that they're on this track, you don't say to them, you're just being oppositional, you're compulsory. I mean, that doesn't help. They say, no, I'm not.
Oh, well, that makes it worse.
Right.
You know,
pointing out any of these to anybody makes it worse.
Yes, that's the first of the do not do.
The do not do's is do not, number one, point to what they're doing. Number two, never expose them to anyone else. Never humiliate them. So let's go back. Another difficult one, is passive-aggressive behavior. Now, this happens with overly nice people. And there are people that you work with, and I know in certain corporations this is true, that you work with people who have developed a strategy of being overly nice. And they are so nice that they get everybody to speak and say everything about everything. They tell secrets about themselves. And the person who is overly nice is gathering this data to use against you. And they will go and they will gossip about you or say something about you to somebody else. But they're overly nice and overly sweet. Mm-hmm. This kind of person becomes very difficult to deal with. And then there's a further, which is the person who has the person who's always late.
Mm-hmm.
How many times have you been frustrated by someone you know who's always late? Always. No matter what you do for them, you're always late. So much so that whenever you make a date with them, you make it a half hour in advance. And you know that they're going to not show up that half hour early, but then you have to show up the half hour early because you told them it was going to be at 12 o'clock, but it was really at 12:30. So you show up at 11:45. It doesn't work. You can't beat the strategy.
And then there's those who set you up and who will say, I said that you should be there at 12 and you got here at 12:15, but no, you told me I should get here at 12:15. No, I said at 12. You know what I mean? There's also the setter-uppers in the passive-aggressive, in my view, where maybe they would set you up, you know, to fail in some way, and you don't realize it until after you've been caught.
Well, you see, that Roberta, is pretty conscious, the person who does that. I'm referring to the most difficult people being the ones who do things unconsciously.
I have found, Armand, that passive-aggressive people are not conscious of their passive-aggressiveness.
Yes. When they set you up, they are.
Well.
Okay. So how about this? How about the person who decides, let's say you just find somebody who's senile. Now, senility is very difficult.
Well.
When I say senility, I mean dementia, and I mean, you know, advanced.
That is one of the most difficult behaviors, I'm going to call it a behavior so that I don't call it anything else, to deal with, because people who are senile repeat themselves hundreds of times. They could ask you 300 times a day, did you put the car in the garage? And every time you say to them, yes, I did, but they forget. So they ask you again, because what's happening is their brain is locked into that question and they can't move on with their life because the brain, it's like a broken record, keeps going to that question. Where is the car? Is it in the garage? So they keep asking you, but 2 minutes later they forgot that they asked you, so they come back. That can drive anyone up the wall because we just don't have that kind of patience. We're
well,
not designed.
Well, again, here's the key. You're bringing up a very important point, Roberta. The key is my impatience makes that drive me up a wall. It will not drive me up a wall. I have a neighbor who asks me, was the mail delivered yet? He's got some form of Alzheimer's. He retired a few years ago, and he's just in his early 60s, but he's showing all the signs of dementia. And every time I pass him by, he greets me in a very nice way and talks to me about the mail not being delivered. And I look at him, and he'll do it over and over again, but I see him, and my heart goes out to him. He's somebody I've known for many years, and I see him, and he asks about the mail. If I'm impatient and I'm rushing past him, I might say, no, leave me alone, Lou. But I don't, because I see the illness and I feel sad for him. I will respond to him in some way. So I think when I get short with him, it's again that it's not his problem. It's my problem.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just what you said a little earlier. How about complaining, people who are always victims, who talk with complaints, and they're talking with complaints, and they want to engage you in this complaining kind of way. And they want to engage you in this thing, and you just don't want to hear it anymore, or you don't have the room for it, or you want to tell them, please take responsibility for yourself. That's another kind of very difficult person to deal with, especially when they're your mother.
Mm. Mm. Yeah, when they're a relative, they're very difficult to deal with because you do love them and you do want to help them and you do feel empathic and you want to help them and you care and everything. But if it becomes a behavior that's repetitive, it can exhaust your reserves and you may end up feeling overwhelmed with their demands. And the point is that no matter how much you give, it's never enough. You could give 5 hours a day to a person like that, and it's never going to be enough, because the moment you hang up the phone, it starts all over again.
But keep in mind, the minute that you give somebody like that 5 hours of your time, it is you who's in the pathological state.
Right.
Because when it gets to that
person,
point,
right,
the difficult person has become you. This is Armand DeMille with Roberta Maria Atti. We're going to be back with you in a little bit. We're going to cover more people and some of more about how you could deal with each one. And, of course, the one that I want to talk about, but I won't, so I'll just mention it now. And don't say anything, Roberta. People with yappy dogs.
Mm.
People with dogs that just go yap, 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 yap all the time. Well, mm-hmm. I guess they enjoy their dogs, too. I'll be right back with you. I have one friend who, if I ever go to a restaurant with him or if he's ever among our friends, he never orders from the menu. He waits. He looks through the menu. And one day I looked at him and I said, friend, listen, we've been waiting for 40 minutes. And he says, I'm sorry. He says, I have pathological ambivalence. It was a great description. Mm-hmm. It meant he can never make a decision.
Yep.
This is Armand DeMille, Roberta Maria Atti. We'll be back with you in a couple of minutes. I got some nice music for you today.
Thank you.
Paris Lovers. Yeah. They call the clarinet a licorice stick. George Lewis, L-E-W-I-S, Jazz at Preservation Hall, an album that is available. You can find it, I know for sure, on iTunes. That's where I downloaded this one, and available elsewhere. The George Lewis Band of New Orleans. That kind of brought us around. And this is Armand DeMille with Roberta Maria Atti. We were tempted to play you some opera today, but I said, you know...
Yeah, that may have been a bit much.
Let's get it down a little. We have some opera here for you to hear as well. Okay, when you see someone going into an attack mode or excessive defense... Oh, this is Armand DeMille, in case you just tuned in, thinking that we play great clarinet music here on WBAI. We do play some. But you're listening to the two golden voices of Roberta Maria Atti, A-T-T-I, and Armand DeMille. And the name of the show is called The Positive Mind, here on WBAI 99.5 FM. And what we've been talking about is dealing with difficult people. Some people are very difficult. I mean, I never understand how you deal with certain difficult people who are known by reputation to be difficult people, such as salespeople, people who want to sell you things. And if they want to sell you things, and I can't tell you how many times I've sat near a dressing room and watched a salesperson telling somebody that the dress looks great on them or the suit looks wonderful, and it looks terrible.
I was just reading the other day, Business Magazine had an article about option arm mortgages. These things are legal, and they are such a trap, Armand. They really put a lot of people in a lot of trouble financially, and the brokers who are selling them know exactly that these most likely are going to spell bankruptcy and loss of a home for someone, but they go ahead and sell them anyway.
So not all salespeople and not all people selling mortgages, or even maybe not even all selling option R mortgages, I don't know, not all people who sell real estate, not every lawyer, you know, who's out there. Can I tell you a story about the lawyer?
Well, there are many stories about lawyers. Which one, Armand?
This is the one about the devil deciding to redecorate hell, and he realizes that it's getting very unpopular. This is because we were playing Mephistopheles, and he wants to put in some air conditioning, you know, and I forgot the reason.
Maybe it's a bit hot down there.
It is hot down there, and I said he kind of needs an architect. And, I think it was heaven that was going to do the redecorating. And so they called up and they said, we need a... we need a decorator. And so, you know, of course, there were quite a few decorators available. They went up to heaven and helped. And the devil said, you know, we need a lawyer. And God said, there are none of them up here. My lawyer friends, there are good lawyers. I'll name a few. I will definitely some good friends. But between lawyers, therapists, psychotherapists who lie to keep the business, physicians who lie to get the surgery. I remember one person who wanted to do a surgery on my hand once, and I went and I got a second opinion, then a third opinion, and all three wanted to do the surgery on my hand. Finally went to a fourth who was a friend of a friend. He said, oh, yes, if you do that, you just won't be able to move your hand up and down anymore. You'll be able to move it every other way. And then when I went back to the other surgeons and they said, is this true? They said, oh, yeah, we forgot to mention that. Because, again, the surgeries... You know, the things they won't tell you. So you have, and this is a problem, because when you are so used to a person representing themselves, hoping they're going to be honest, real estate salesman, But knowing that by nature they have to be dishonest because they make their dollar by you buying something. People selling things on the telephone when they call you up, unsolicited. You know, so how do you deal with these difficult people? And they're very difficult type. I mean, these are people who just are not going to be truthful. And it means that's their job. Now, they may have starving children that they have to feed by doing this work. So I'm not going to put them down for doing the work. But they become one of the difficult. Scattered people are very difficult. You know, people who are every which way, and they don't have a way of landing in one place. And if you talk to them, it's kind of you start a conversation, then they move on somewhere else. Mm. And then you move them back, and then you try to catch them. And they always say, well, nobody ever showed me. Nobody ever told me. Nobody ever, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And they somehow escape having missed the point.
Mm-hmm.
Very difficult to deal with. Manic people. Manic people, if you know anything about mania, it's a kind of an illness. And when it happens, it's people who are... They're just on a positive rush in such a way that it's a frenzy. They're impossible to deal with, impossible to interrupt.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they can become obsessive, I guess. What about people that keep you on the phone, well, that try to keep you on the phone, and no matter how many times you say, I have to go, no, but let me just finish this. Someone's waiting for me. Let me just finish this one sentence. I have an appointment. You know, I haven't finished telling you. Let me just say this. It's going to take a couple of minutes. And no matter how many times you say that, they just won't let you go. That's a form of being difficult.
It's also a form of control. It's kind of amazing.
Mm.
Because, you know, salespeople are trained to do this to someone.
Mm-hmm.
Never let a person off the phone. You know, you're trained, and that's one of the difficulties. It's like you have a way, they have ways, and they have records, and they test a person after he goes through his training. They give him a cold call, and they just judge him not on whether or not he makes a sale, but how long he can keep the person on the phone.
Mm-hmm.
You know, hey, do you like movies?
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? And that'll start the conversation. How long can you keep a person going becomes your power play over them. And they think you're talking to them, but what you're really doing is keeping them around. And again, it is the way that people work. Critical people, you know, there are boasting people now. That's another difficult one.
Boasting, you mean people who are always describing their accomplishments and how
yes.
successful they are.
And comparing themselves to other people.
They do things better than anyone and that kind of boasting?
Boasting. They go kind of, they're always more than proud of themselves.
Mm.
And they set themselves above the fray so that, you know, you will believe that they are powerful.
You know, when I moved to the U.S., everyone in my family was very impressed with me because, you know, in Italy when I was a kid, anyone who emigrated to America was someone either very smart or very lucky. So when I went back, there was this one friend of my family who was one of these people. And, of course, she couldn't say... you know, what the other people would say, which was, wow, this is great. Now you live there. How is it? Is it true? Is it really that nice? She asked me where I lived, and I said, you know, it was something other than New York at the time. And she said, well, my friend lives in the States too, but she would only live in New York City, of course, because, you know. And so it was like everything one does is never quite good enough for these people, and they either them themselves or someone they know have done something better.
It's one-upping. And what it means...
Yes, one-upping. I like that.
And what it means, Roberta, is it means I feel inadequate.
Mm.
You see, when somebody does any of these behaviors, we want to remember they feel inadequate. When someone starts screaming at you, they are feeling inadequate. We didn't talk about people who are on medication. And I would just like to take a quick minute because many of you are dealing with people who are either hormonally bent out of shape at any given moment, men or women, or they have taken medication, especially painkillers, you know. Now, if a person is known that they just had something happen to them and they're taking painkillers to sustain themselves for a period of time, the one thing you don't want to do is get into an argument with them because they're going to flip their wig. Because they – I haven't used that expression in ages. You know what that means?
Well, I saw the image of
you
it.
You saw the image? They're going to flip their wig.
Mm-hmm.
Because they're going to go off the edge because they don't have the inhibitors that stop them from overreacting.
Mm-hmm.
So if you're getting into an argument with somebody who's on drugs, you have to question yourself. What are you doing?
Right.
If you're getting into an argument with somebody who is drunk – what are you doing?
Yeah,
except to get out of the way. If that person's blocking your way, you may scream at them and get around them. But you got to get out of there.
Yeah, whenever you have a chemical substance that messes with the impulse control of an individual, that's not the time to have an argument with them or to try to stop them or to try to convince them of anything. It's just not going to work.
And when you see somebody bent out of shape and you decide, when somebody starts screaming and you start screaming back, you must realize that they are not the difficult person, you both are. Because there is no two-sided screaming. There's only one side.
Mm-hmm.
And the other person has to be sane enough to say, this person is screaming, therefore, this is not going to work. There is no logic left here. There is no common ground here. So after the unreasonable, if you're in an unreasonable salvo, let's say somebody comes after you like a boss, here's one of the tricks you could do if you're involved with it. Usually when somebody accuses you of a whole bunch of things, what a person tends to do is find one thing that they disagree with, and then try to invalidate the person by saying the one thing that they disagree with. Like saying, you know, no, I never saw that movie. You see, you told me I saw that movie, or when I went to that movie, I never went to that movie. And you stick on one little part of the whole argument. Instead, when somebody, especially a boss or a higher up, starts berating you in any way, understand that their impulse is out of the way, and the way to calm them down is to pick anything that they are saying that is accurate. So if they say to you, that in some way you screwed up.
You're no good because you're always late.
You're always late, and no, you were late this morning, and you were late last week, and you were late, and you're late all the time. What you do is you pick one kernel of it, and you agree with it. You're right, I was late this morning. That was my mistake. And you don't make up excuses. You find one part of their argument and you validate it. Mind you, this is the opposite of what the tendency is to do. The tendency is to find one part and invalidate it.
Or to defend yourself.
That's it. That's what I mean. Yeah. And defend yourself by invalidating what they're saying, arguing with them. No. Find one part and argue with it and agree with it. And then try to get them to say it to you and try to repeat it back. Now, remember this wonderful expression I once learned. There is something that I am doing that seems to be getting you very angry. Because when a person talks to you in an angry way, you could look at them and say, there seems to be something about me that's bothering you a great deal. Can you tell me what it is so I could stop doing it? You disarm people that way. Because when they have an attitude, and it's the attitude that's coming at you, if you ask them to spell it out, they stop. Offer to a difficult person your best guess as to what they're feeling and ask for feedback. You know, it sounds like you're very angry. Is that true? Ask them to talk to you, and you'll find that they'll come off the screaming onto giving you details. And resist the urge to fight to win the argument. There is no winning. When two people, I often wonder when couples are screaming at each other, what's the idea? Is the idea that I'm going to scream at you and you're going to scream at me and I'm going to scream at you and you're going to scream at me and eventually one of us is going to say, aha, I see what you're saying. I am totally wrong. I apologize. Is that what you think is going to happen when you're screaming at somebody? It has never happened. It won't happen. So if the two of you are screaming at each other, there is no place to settle in. There is no spot. Unless you exhaust each other and you take some kind of a break. You know, people who scream at each other very often do it as a form of intimacy.
Mm-hmm.
Roberta, they do it as a way of exciting themselves. So back to what we could do. If the symptoms only seem to occur when the person is under stress, you know, if you notice about somebody you love that they only get this way under stress, wait till they're not under stress. And then when you see somebody go into an attacked mode, recognize that it's useless to argue with them. Keep your own self of self-confidence. Don't let yourself be verbally abused. But now comes one of the most important things about what we could do with people who we find the most difficult and how they can become our very, very best teachers.
Well, I'm just going to share my own experience with this and what has worked for me, not assuming that it works, it's going to work for anyone else, but just sharing it with the intent of, with the hope that it might. What I have discovered is, Armand, that whenever I am disturbed by someone else's behavior, what really disturbs me is not necessarily that person's action, but rather whatever it reflects of my own being that I do not like, or something I'm lacking, you know, like those women this morning that were so cheerful at 8 a.m. Maybe, like I said before, maybe I have to ask myself, is it bothering me because I can't be like that at this time of day? So one of the ways I have found that's most effective in dealing with difficult people has been to use the difficult individual as a mirror for myself and to find what it is that I need to change about Roberta that would make my interaction with that person easier for me, let alone for them. This is not done in order to be a good person, to be a saint, or to be liked by other people. This is done in order to make my life easier, because if I can figure out how to not get triggered, well, you know, that makes things easier for me. And so everyone who comes along, you know, the person who is rude unnecessarily, the person who treats others with disrespect, when I ask myself, what are they reflecting of me? That, number one, gets me out of the need to engage in an argument because it moves me away from my emotions and into my mind. And I take refuge in my intellect when my emotions threaten to be overwhelming. So that gives me a moment of respite. And it doesn't always work. But I find that the more I use it, the better I am at it. So I move away from the emotion and into the mind. And then I find that part of me that feels like them about something. So if the person that I'm dealing with, let's say, is angry, well, I find the part of me that is angry. And I validate that part of me. And I tell myself, gee, yes, you have a right to feel that way. And that automatically gives me a much bigger space in my heart for that person. And, you know, I guess you can figure the rest because I think we're almost out of time. But I think I've shared what is important for me in dealing with difficult people.
Yeah, you know, it's like I think what you said, Roberta, as well, is that it's always a part of us. It's always a part of us that we see manifested. And there are certain parts that are supposed to stay hidden. And some people just can't hide it. Maybe we're all nervous. Maybe we're all aggressive. Maybe we're all proud and boasting. Maybe we're all that way, but we inhibit all of these things. The difficult person, finally, I want to bring in. I want to talk about energetic shifts. You know, when you have a difficult person in your life, they change your energy. Whatever energy field you have at the moment, let's say you're feeling peaceful, like you did, Roberta, this morning on the train, they have a different energy. And when you're state of energy is tenuous when it's not solid yet. When you wake up and you feel calm, but you're not solidly calm yet, you're still working on it to find that spot, a high energy can come in and disrupt you. Or when you're feeling really good, if that really good feeling is not solid yet, a depressed energy or a negative energy can drag you down. So very often what we're looking at, when we're looking at and thinking about trying to find people that are difficult to deal with, is we're looking for the energetic shift. We're looking at, oh, this person, their energy is different than mine. And what I'm fighting is the energy shift inside myself. And what I need to do is find out how I could feel more solid in the energy that I carry and the one that I want to go around with, rather than the one that they are carrying, you know, that just shakes me off my timbers.
Mm-hmm.
This is Armand DeMille with Roberta Maria Atti. My special thanks to you, Roberta Maria, for being with me and helping me with this program today.
Thank you, Armand.
How do people reach you if they need to?
My website is www.creativehealthsolutions.org.
And I'll be back with you tomorrow at 1 p.m., my friends. This is Armand DeMille, The Positive Mind, WBAI, thepositivemind.com for more information.